psychological trauma and the effects of being a victim. It is the case that we have natural mechanisms, natural defenses, things that come into play when we are threatened or we're put in danger. And these are the mechanisms that they're part of our evolutionary heritage. They're the things that prepare us either to run away or to fight. Well, the question we'll look at this morning is, what happens when we can't do either of those things? What happens when one is in a situation when you can't run away and where struggling, fighting, resisting won't do any good, where nothing that you will do will make any difference? Then the same mechanisms that prepare us to run away or to fight are twisted, are warped, are changed. And then what we see is psychological trauma. It is an affliction of the powerless. It is what happens when people are put into situations where they face overwhelming force. And we can see it in many different areas. We can see it in people who have experienced combat. But we can also see it in people who have experienced torture, political terrorism, domestic violence, rape, child abuse. The same sorts of threads run through all of these things. We'll be talking this morning with a researcher who has looked at these patterns and has written about it. Her name is Judith Herman. She is a physician. She is associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. She is also director of training at the Victims of Violence Program at Cambridge Hospital and psychiatric director and a founding member of the Women's Mental Health Center in Somerville, Massachusetts. She is the author of a previous book entitled Father-Daughter Incest, which won the C. Wright Mills Award of the Society for the Study of Social Problems in 1981, and is the author of a new, recently published book entitled Trauma and Recovery, The Aftermath of Violence from Domestic Abuse to Political Terror, which takes a look at the mechanisms of trauma. What happens? How do people respond? How do people then respond long after the event is over? And it talks about the common threads that run through different sorts of experiences that we'll talk about. And it also talks about how it is then that people in the counseling field can help survivors of these various experiences, torture, combat, sexual abuse, domestic violence, can help these people to heal. The book, by the way, if you'd like to look at it, is published by Basic Books, Trauma and Recovery. And also, as we talk this morning, if you'd like to call and talk with our guest, Dr. Judith Herman, you should feel free to call in and do that. The telephone number here locally, 333-WILL or 9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere you can hear us, and that number is 800-222-WILL. So 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL, those are the numbers. Dr. Herman, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Perhaps it would be interesting for people to hear how it is that you became drawn into this work and what your particular interest is, how it came about.
Well, this began, I don't think anybody sets out to get involved with survivors of horrible experiences. The way it began for me was way back when I was in training as a psychiatric resident. I saw a number of women who disclosed to me in confidence that they had been sexually abused in childhood. And I would go to my supervisors and say, you know, what do I do? What do I do with this? How do I help? And you know, back in the dark ages then, my supervisor would either say to me, well, poor naive resident, don't you understand that women just make these things up? They fantasize about this sort of thing. You know, the profession was in a certain amount of denial back then. Or they would say, well, yes, it happened, but don't talk about it. Don't touch it because the patient can't handle it. And, of course, we were the ones who couldn't handle it. So to the extent that I followed my supervisor's advice, I didn't do very well with with my patients. My patients wanted a safe place to be able to tell what happened to them. I don't know, somehow those experiences really kind of stuck in my mind, and when I began to see more and more and more women who had been sexually abused, had been victims of violence, eventually I kind of went with my instinct rather than what I'd been taught, and began listening and giving people a place to tell their stories, and that worked much better.
Mm-hmm. I know you're feeling about the book is that perhaps the contribution it makes to our thinking about all this is that it says that these experiences you've been talking about, the experience of being experience of domestic violence, mm-hmm. Or sexual abuse, mm-hmm. is in some important ways connected to other kinds of violence, and we can say that people who have experienced combat, mm-hmm. and people who have been victims of political terrorism or torture, mm-hmm. And along with people who have been victimized by parents, by spouses, mm-hmm. by other people in their life, there are some kind of important threads that run through all of these experiences and say that, in a sense, it's very much all one experience.
That's right. That's right. And I think we're a little more used, thanks to some of the work of the combat veterans and the anti-war movement, I think we're a little more used to taking it seriously now when our returning soldiers, for example, have been traumatized, and we realize they've been in combat and they've been injured psychologically, even if their physical injuries aren't obvious, their psychological ones are just as real. I think it's taken a while to understand that violence is violence and terror is terror, and whether that's happening in your home or on the battlefield, the response is very much the same.
Mm-hmm. I thought we might talk a little bit about the inbred, sort of hardwired mechanisms that people have, that humans have, mm-hmm. to respond to danger. Because mm-hmm. this is something that it's very much part of our evolutionary heritage. This is the thing that gets us. When confronted with danger, it gets us ready either to fight or to run away.
That's right.
It's completely automatic. It just sort of, there's sort of systems that are there, they switch on, and they're there for our protection. But something happens when one is in a situation where you can't run away, where you can't fight, or if you did, it would be no use, where you're the victim of overwhelming force, and nothing you do is going to make any difference.
That's right. I think in order to understand how traumatized people respond, you first have to understand that we have built into our biology very strong and good and mechanisms for self-protection, and we're lucky we have them. When we're faced with danger, we go into a kind of state of alert, one thing that happens is that we get quite agitated. We get a lot of energy, and it's very focused on the situation at hand. And we can ignore all of the subtleties of the surroundings, and we also ignore things like hunger or pain or fatigue, because we need to have all our energy available. So people get very aroused and concentrated. We're also kind of ignoring the nuances of the situation. This is when you're facing danger, that's not the time to kind of see the shades of gray or to kind of be reflective. You've got to respond fast, and you've got to respond on instinct. So people have a kind of all or nothing response, and people get frightened and angry. There are emotional components to facing danger, and that's a help too when you're dealing with an attack or someplace where you're facing imminent bodily harm. It helps to be frightened, and it helps to be angry. It gets us organized to fight or to run away. The trouble is, when you can't fight and we can't run away, then those emotions and those responses don't go away. They mm-hmm. stick around, and they stick around even long after the trauma is over.
Mm-hmm. That raises an interesting question about why that happens. It's as if, if you look for analogies, maybe you could think of it as being a program, for example, that is switched on,
mm-hmm.
and yet the conditions for it being turned off somehow never come, so the program continues to go and go and go and go and go.
I think that's a very nice analogy. It's as though the situation has never been resolved, uh-huh. because whatever action it is that you took wasn't effective. And so you're continuing to react as though the danger is still present because you haven't gotten that resolution that you need. And in fact, I think that's the principle we follow to jump ahead of the game a little bit when we do therapy, is to help people come to terms with and resolve the trauma of what happened to them, and that does sometimes give some relief.
Let me just reintroduce real quick for anybody who might have tuned in last minute or two. We're talking with Dr. Judith Herman. She's Associate Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School, and we are talking a little bit about some of what is in her recent book, Trauma and Recovery, which takes a look at the aftermath of violence and how it is that people experience psychological trauma. The results of being in a situation where one is confronted with violence, danger, injury, and where one is powerless to resist, something that we can see in a number of situations, as her subtitle suggests, going all the way from domestic violence to political terror. So the book is about how people experience that. It's also about helping people recover, and that's what we're talking about. If you have questions or comments, you can give us a call. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You talk about the fact that the symptoms that people experience seem to fall into basically three categories. And it may be that people will be able to understand them, or they will start right away thinking of examples, because we have since the period, say, after the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. especially as we got into about a decade or so after, mm-hmm. we started to think a lot more about post-traumatic stress disorder.
That's right.
And so people, I think, got used to the idea that that was something that could be associated with combat. And I think what you're doing is taking things a step further and saying that it can be associated with all sorts of violent situations that people may be in that we might not right at the beginning think of, but then when you think about it for a little bit, you can see that the parallels are there.
Right.
So the three, maybe we could talk a little bit about each of these three things. One is a kind of constantly being on guard, as you have talked about. If one's threatened with danger, you're sort of primed for action. You're sort of ready. You're waiting. You're looking for the threat to come, the attack. Mm-hmm. What happens, though, is that people then, as a result of this experience, then they can never let their guard down. They're sort of constantly on guard, to the point where the slightest sort of slight little things that for everybody else you wouldn't even think about can sort of set them off. It's sort of the proverbial car backfiring, and when the combat veteran wanting to dive for the ditch because, to him that noise is someone shooting at him.
That's right. I think people who've been traumatized suffer from a kind of what we call hyperarousal. What that means is that they're constantly on the alert, and they're going to react to the smallest reminder or even anything that would be unexpected or the kind of thing that most of us tune out in the course of the day or would consider a minor annoyance will be overwhelming and terrifying for someone who's already been traumatized. One example that I think of often, which city dwellers will respond to, is the automobile alarm, the car alarms that often go off and make a loud, repetitive noise. And, it's a loud, disagreeable noise that most of us when we hear these days, we hear it the first time and we jump out of our seats, and then we say, oh, well, it's a car alarm, and we don't do, in fact, what the person who had the car alarm wanted us to do, which is to run out and see what's the matter with the car. We say, oh, it's a car alarm, and we tune it out. We ignore it. People with PTSD can't tune it out. Every time that sound goes off, they're going to jump. And they're going to jump each time as though it's new and as though it's a surprise. Mm-hmm. So that there's no such thing as kind of getting used to this condition. It doesn't get better by itself over time. Mm-hmm. As a result, people find that they're very irritable. They don't sleep well. And they think oftentimes that they're going crazy because it's as though their bodies have been reset and they don't have any kind of baseline anymore where they can calm down and feel, you know, alert but relaxed.
Yeah. Another thing that these folks report that they will tell you about is that long after the especially if it was a single sort of event, or maybe a limited number of events, long after that's done, they keep reliving it, and it's not. I suppose it's not just as if they have a memory and that they're sort of remembering it as if it's an event. They're remembering an event that happened in the past. It is that they continue to experience it as if it is happening now.
That's right. People will say it's like watching a movie, except they're in the movie. And they're more in the movie of what happened at that traumatic moment than they are in their present lives. I think that actually when we're faced with overwhelming danger, we don't store memories the way we ordinarily do. I mean, ordinary memories for most of us are kind of a verbal narrative, and they're part of our life story. They're integrated into who we were before and who we've become since, and they're just one part of our lives. But traumatic memories aren't like that. They take over, and they're not so verbal as ordinary memories. They're much more physical. They're much more sensual. There are sights and smells and sounds, and people will say, I remember the feeling of cold or the rain or the light or the sound of the guns or the helicopters or the breathing of the rapist.
Mm-hmm. The third thing, and what's sort of interesting about this is that it's really in contradiction to or in opposition to, in some ways, the things we've talked about before, especially hyperarousal, is that people will say that when you get in a situation where you're completely powerless, where there's no point in resisting, people may simply surrender. And that you escape not by escaping literally, but by escaping emotionally, psychologically, by, in a psychological sense, removing yourself from the situation, by shutting down emotionally. And then what sometimes happens is that people can never then restart. I mean, they talk about feeling numb, feeling as if a part of them had died, which is sort of the other side of the coin from hyperarousal being constantly sort of like a clenched fist. This is sort of like constantly just being empty and kind of shut off.
That's right. And what many people will describe is that they flip back and forth between the two states, but they can't find the middle ground. I think besides the fight or flight response, there is a freeze response that it doesn't happen to everybody. But sometimes when you're in a completely helpless situation, what will happen is that you will kind of shut down both emotionally and even in terms of sensations. People will sometimes describe that when they were absolutely helpless, they froze, they couldn't move, and they couldn't really feel much. And some people will even have an out-of-body experience where they'll say, you know, I kind of left my body and I floated up above it and I watched the rape or the sexual abuse or the shooting or whatever happen. And it felt as though it was happening to somebody else, and I just stayed very calm and I didn't feel it. Now, once people have had that experience, and I think it is a kind of a, it's a kind of a mercy in a way if you're utterly helpless and there's nothing else you can do, it is somewhat protective to at least escape this way. But what people will find in the aftermath is that they can't turn that off either. And so they're going back and forth between feeling everything and feeling nothing, feeling rage and terror or feeling numb. And neither state feels normal, and neither state feels connected to other people.
Well, we're about midway through our conversation here, and I do have two callers we'll get right to. So
okay.
I want to make sure that they know we won't keep them waiting any longer. Our guest again this morning is Dr. Judith Herman from the Harvard Medical School, and she's the author of the book Trauma and Recovery, The Aftermath of Violence from Domestic Abuse to Political Terror, and it's published by Basic Books, if you would like to read it.
That in the reactions of people who are suddenly, you might say, imprisoned, akin somewhat to political prisoners or the airline hijackees, people like that. Have you ever read the memoirs of Albert Speer, Hitler's chief architect? Because in these memoirs, of course, he was a very highly educated man, and he was one of the most highly privileged members of the Third Reich, and he notes the reactions of his the other high party leaders at Nuremberg, and then in their very long stretch of imprisonment, he mentions that at Berlin, the Allied powers, of course, kept them in very, very close confinement under very almost minute surveillance in their tiny cells and with lights playing on them, so they couldn't sleep very well at night. And he did sort of mind games, and in fact, he maintains he almost reached a state of mental suspended aberration. That is, he just he closed down his mind and somehow went into sort of a trance-like state, at least at the beginning of his long imprisonment. It's fascinating reading, really.
Yes, I haven't read those memoirs, but I've read a number of prison diaries of political prisoners, and it does seem clear that prisoners who are confined, especially if they are being mistreated or abused, or if they're living in fear all the time of what might happen to them, will teach each other oftentimes explicitly how to put themselves into trance, how to use various relaxation techniques or mind control techniques to manage their fear and their pain that they're suffering from. So it's a fairly common response. Many prisoners of war or people who've been in concentration camps will often also describe how other inmates taught them to use mind control techniques to cope because they were in an inescapable situation.
Hmm. Let's go on and take another caller here. We'll go to line number one, one of our local lines. Hello.
Yeah, I wanted to inquire about the particularity of Vietnam veterans. The post-traumatic syndrome is not just trauma to them. It's having perpetrated trauma. And I don't know if you saw the rather controversial front line on My Lai. It described someone who was so many years later still an absolute basket case from what having killed, you know, 16 or 18 women and children. And there's sort of a continuity between that and domestic violence from the male psyche. It seems that they don't seem to deal with it. They just perpetrate again, basically. I don't know if you've really examined that. I'm not, making any defense for this. I'm just saying that.
Right. Well, it's a very complicated question that you're raising, whether some survivors or victims do go on to become perpetrators, and whether, in fact, that's more common with with men who've been victimized. I can tell you this. It does seem clear, there's some pretty strong literature about this now, that looks at what happened to our Vietnam vets and it's pretty clear that the heavier the combat exposure, the more likely the soldier was to develop post-traumatic stress. And the folks who seemed to have the worst PTSD of all were the ones who'd either witnessed or actually participated in abusive violence, atrocities against others. They did not fare well. They did not recover well 10 and 15 and even 20 years later. There's, I do think we certainly see when we're looking at our abused kids, too, how some badly abused kids clearly do go on to perpetrate against others if they, don't recover well. The thing I always hesitate about is when we're talking about this kind of cycle of violence is that I think it's important to, for the sake of victims, to understand that most victimized people don't turn it around and attack others. In fact, it's surprising how few, considering what's been done to them, it's really surprising how few victimized people actually take revenge either against their perpetrators or take it out on other people. Most survivors don't act out violently against others.
That isn't really the question I was asking, but I know it's a common one that's asked, and it's mm-hmm. probably a good one to address as well. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that all this is tied up gender identity and militarism, and it seems that we've kicked the Vietnam syndrome by, burying corpses in Panama and mm-hmm. burying Iraqis alive in Iraq, and
well,
et cetera. I don't know what's next, actually.
I guess we've tried to kick it, but I think I would see that as much more a reenactment of the traumatic situation and a sign that we haven't recovered. If we don't recover, if we don't learn from these experiences, then we keep not only reliving them, but sometimes reenacting them in other situations. And that's unfortunately, one of the ways that this kind of thing perpetuates itself.
Let us continue and take another caller on our toll-free line again. Hello.
The first half hour, the things you were talking about, sorts of experiences and the strategies people use to disengage themselves from the situation they found themselves in.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend mm-hmm. Who's bipolar, post-traumatic stress disorder, and over a number of years now, it's finally coming out, sort of what has happened in her early childhood. It seems she was smacked in the face rather randomly. In other words, sometimes no association with any situation that even if your one was violently oriented, wouldn't be doing those things. It was just sort of out of the blue.
Right.
And this child switched everything off, as you mentioned.
Right.
And just before you talked to this last person, you were talking about they usually don't turn violent toward the perpetrator,
mm-hmm.
nor do they, become psychopaths or sociopaths mm-hmm. destroying property or something. Isn't it, and this is what this person does, they harm themselves in some way.
That's much, much more common.
I would like for you to speak to that. Basically because I'm taping this, and this woman, she tries to keep up on the latest kind of stuff to help her, and she's found a psychiatrist now who pretty well believes what she says is going on, allows her to more or less structure her own self-recovery coming out of an institution. And I'd wish if you could speak to any of those kinds of things. I'm unfortunately probably will not be able to get your book quickly. And we're right in a situation now where we're at a plateau and there's a step supposed to be coming up. And largely, how her support group react will determine that. And your input would be very helpful because there's relatives out there who believe in the bootstrap theory.
Right,
get your
right.
stuff together and everything will be okay. And
don't talk about the past.
Right, I'll hop off. Thanks a lot. Excellent program.
Right. First, let me say that if you do, for people who might want to get hold of the book and don't have it available locally at your bookstore, Basic Books does have an 800 number where you can order the book, and perhaps we should make that number available on the program.
Sure.
It's 800-331-3761. Let me comment on a couple of things that you brought up about your friend, because they're fairly typical things that we hear very often in our own Victims of Violence program. First of all, the description of the kind of violence that she was exposed to as a child, where it was kind of random and she never knew when to expect it, that's what we hear from many, many of our adult survivors, that it wasn't even, the violence might not even have happened that often, but it was, it happened often enough to instill a lot of fear, a lot of terror, and to make the child feel that, that she always had to be on her guard because she never knew when it was going to happen. That kind of climate of coercive control, as we call it, of chronic victimization, chronic terror, can be very destructive to a developing child. The child develops not only the simple post-traumatic stress syndrome that we've already talked about, but she really starts to have her personality formed by this climate of terror. It's not just a one-time experience if it's a parent or someone close who's doing the abusing. It becomes her whole world, and it really does have an impact on forming her personality. One of the things that kids do to adapt is to kind of tune out, shut down. The other thing that kids do to adapt, and this is really in order to, because they've really got to keep their attachment to their parents, they've got to have faith and trust in their parents. Kids need that very much. They'll blame themselves. They'll say, this is happening because I'm bad, and I deserve it, and I need to be punished. And they'll end up punishing themselves. And if they're trying to deal with overwhelming feelings, they won't act out against others. Usually they'll act out against themselves and begin to harm themselves in a number of different ways. It can become quite an intractable problem later on, because kids often find as well that they get some relief. At least they're in when they're hurting themselves, at least they're in control of the situation. And the physical pain that they inflict is often not nearly as much preferable, actually, to the emotional pain that they're feeling. So kids can become very self-destructive. We see a lot of people coming for psychiatric treatment later on who've had this kind of history in childhood. And it really, it does help to start to validate what happened, to see the connections between the symptoms you're having now and what happened in the past. It doesn't change the past, but it begins to make sense out of it.
Well, I hope that that gets to the points that the caller was interested in. It makes me think about a couple of things, and I think the story that he told, and using that as an example, perhaps will help people make the leap between the sort of the examples that will come to mind. We've talked about combat. We've talked about people being in prison, and that fits the model really well, and people will be able to accept that. But this, I would hope, would make people make the leap to the fact that your home could be a prison.
That's right.
And, you know, a child can be a victim of terrorism. It can be just as much as if someone was in a real prison or someone was the victim of political terrorism. The experience of being terrorized and held captive can happen in all sorts of places, and there don't have to be the same kind of walls, you know, that we would think of right away.
Yeah, including the home, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And one of the astonishing things, I think, is that if you read the descriptions of the method of operation, if you will, of some batterers or incest offenders, they really do sound very similar to what political prisoners describe, that there's violence, but it might be infrequent, and it's capricious. And in between, what you get is a very tyrannical enforcement of petty rules, a lot of what I described earlier as coercive control, and not just negative, but sometimes positive reinforcement kind of capriciously thrown in so that the person is never knows what to expect, and sometimes she's living in terror and fear of what's going to happen, and all of a sudden, for no apparent reason, she's treated nicely. That, in fact, works much better than a steady diet of unremitting fear in terms of kind of breaking someone's will and making someone fearful and obedient.
Mm-hmm. We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest this morning is Dr. Judith Herman. She's an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. She is also director of training at the Victims of Violence Program at Cambridge Hospital and is the author of the book Trauma and Recovery. It's published by Basic Books. We do have some other people to talk with, so we will do that. Line two is next.
Yes, I'd like to address what you talked about earlier, the freeze reaction. And what exactly is the current psychiatric approach to dealing with that, sort of the numbness of the emotions?
Well, I think we're very much in the learning stage in terms of what works. I think, and we use everything ranging from biological methods to interpersonal and social methods to try to counteract the numbing and withdrawal and the kind of sense of deadening that traumatized people feel. On the biological end of things, we are, it's all still very experimental, we are seeing some encouraging results with some of the recent research with serotonin reuptake blockers. But I think the mainstay of our treatment is still more psychological and social. We, you know, what survivors talk about when they talk about what helped them overcome, what helped them kind of re-engage with life, is some kind of relationship that became important to them. Whether that was supportive friends, whether that was a love relationship, whether that was a therapy relationship. And sometimes it can be a one-on-one situation. Sometimes it's a group situation. One of the things that many people who've been through a traumatic experience will say is that they felt numb and alone and withdrawn until they were in the presence of other people who'd been through the same thing. And then they didn't feel so ashamed and they didn't feel so different. And that's why I think the rap groups for combat veterans or for rape survivors or incest survivors have been so successful.
Mm-hmm. Sort of an emotional experience that's almost, you know, as powerful.
It's as powerful, and they really know that everyone else has been there, and everyone understands what they're talking about and doesn't think it's crazy. And, you know, some of the, I think some of the numbing is, and the withdrawal is made worse because our society doesn't understand very well. You know, the returning vet is told to just, you know, well, hey, my generation went off to war and came back and didn't whine and complain. Let's get on with life. And same thing for the survivors of rape or incest. You know, why are you whining about the past? So, or what did you do to bring it on yourself? So our response as a society hasn't been very understanding, to put it mildly. When survivors are in the company of others who've been through the same thing, sometimes that wall breaks down and they really do start to feel reconnected.
Yeah, and the traumatic response is very subtle, so it doesn't tend to affect anyone but the victim.
Well, it can indirectly, of course, affect anyone close to the victim, because
right.
People close to the victim often won't understand that the way the traumatized person is kind of oscillating back and forth between being withdrawn and being very irritable and angry, or very clinging and frightened. So sometimes families are a little bit traumatized, too, and certainly when they hear the stories, they can start having nightmares as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Another caller here, again on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes. This is all very interesting. I want to go back to the children, the child that you were talking about before.
Right.
And what I was wondering was if you've been looking at anything about connected with schools and violence in schools. Some time ago, I heard a talk among school people, principals and superintendents, saying that in certain urban schools, they were talking about Florida at the moment, that violence, weapons, all that you've been talking about, is so common and is going to be so much a part of the school scene that they just have to learn to grow up in that and accept it. I that just doesn't sound like a very good thing to me at all. And so I'm wondering if in the course of your studies you have either run across or started to look towards the consequences of this same sort of capricious terrorist life that's being lived in a great many high schools.
That we have, and, you know, unfortunately, it's not just schools either. I think there are parts of our country now where kids are growing up in what feels like a war zone. And both in their homes, in their neighborhoods, and in their schools, they are not safe, and they are not safe most of the time. They're having to adapt to conditions of chronic terror. Now, there is no way to get used to it. There is no way to just learn to live with it in a healthy way, because it's not a it's like trying to adapt to living on top of a toxic dump. It's not a situation that you can live in a healthy manner.
Well, I was wondering is whether you would look at study this area and write something about this so that
we have at our hospital what we call our community crisis intervention team, and this is a team that has had some training to respond when there is an incident of violence in a community that has traumatized, as you say, not just one person but a whole community. We do go into the community and work with the teachers and principals if it's a school or whatever the community is, to try to help that community take power back. And what we found works for individual recovery also works for community. That is to say, people do best when they build up their support systems and start to take, rather than to just kind of get used to it and take it, when they start to figure out what kind of actions they can take to get organized and to deal with the root cause of the problem. They feel much better, their symptoms get better, and they start to recover from that sense of helplessness that violence instills in all of us.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, but you're not working on that in particular then?
As I say, I personally Cambridge Hospital, 1493 Cambridge Street in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
1493. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. We're coming down here to the point where we only have a couple of minutes left, and I wish we could continue to talking because there are many areas that we haven't explored. I guess one last thing maybe we might talk a little bit about. You know, most of us, I guess, go around in the world thinking that more or less we're in control of our environment, that the world in a way makes sense, it's predictable, and that we have people that we can rely on to help us, at least those people that we're really close to, they're close to us. What happens when one experiences this kind of violence is it seems that all that goes right out the window. The message of this kind of violence seems to be is that the world doesn't make sense, that there is danger and evil in the world, and it's sort of random and unpredictable, and there's really no way to be in control. And the worst thing is, especially for those people who've been victimized by people close to them, is that those people who should take care of us, those are the people that have betrayed us. Which then means that, you know, for a long time afterwards, you go around feeling like no one's going to take care of you. And if someone tells you that they will, you're always sort of thinking, oh, yeah, right, I've heard that one before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how does one restore to these folks a sense of control over themselves, of their environment, and their ability to, again, trust in people who try to get close to them?
Well, I think you've named the problem exactly. If the problem is restoring a sense of trust, of safety, and control. I think the way we go about that is, first of all, we need to name the problem. We need to let people know who've been traumatized know that we know what's happened, that we believe them, we understand what's happened. It really helps to explain that they're not crazy, that they're having a normal response to a horrible event, and that, of course, their sense of safety and trust has been disrupted, and it's going to need to be rebuilt slowly. But that's the task that we face when we embark on the task of recovery, and it helps to know that that's what we're doing. Trust, you know, it doesn't just come from words. It comes from actions. It comes from people learning who they can indeed count on, who will be there for them, who will be willing to listen and hear the story and not pass judgment and be supportive. But the truth is that there are people in the world who do listen and who do understand and who are willing to help. There are also people who won't, and part of the recovery is sort of figuring out who your friends are and learning to reach out to them. Mm-hmm. And depend on them. Some people who have survived will sometimes say, well, you know, I wouldn't wish this experience on anyone. It was a hard way to learn these lessons, but I know what's important now, and I know who my real friends are, and I know what my values really are, and that's something positive that I've taken out of this awful experience.
Well, we will have to stop there. I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest is Dr. Judith Herman, and if you would like to read more of her book on this topic, it is entitled Trauma and Recovery, and it's published by Basic Books.